the end of class size time, I'll be discussing the segment of the period's jazz history, that of the so-called swing era, the band era of jazz, which runs from the late 1920s into the 1940s. This particular period is, of course, a time in which a number of bands vie for the audience of America. It's a considerable number of bands playing a variety of styles of music, from hot jazz to sweet style of music, sort of people would associate today with reruns of the Lawrence Welk show. Among the band leaders, none was more significant in many respects, as I indicated at the end of class, than Edward Kennedy Elliman, a composer, an arranger, and the leader of a distinguished ensemble of musicians whose distinctive instrumental timbres and personal compository styles inspired his composition. He wrote works to bring them out. They also derived enormous creative inspiration from working with Elliott. Over the years, not surprisingly, some who had joined the band early in their careers left to pursue other musical opportunities. A number of people have observed that many of these individuals did not play as well or as creatively when they were out on their own, compared to how well and creatively they played when they were part of the Ellington band. Ellington was interested in a variety of colors and timbres, assembling various instrumental groups in different ways, featuring soloists against the backdrop of the band. And he also was quite creative in his composition. An example of this is a composition from 1930, comparatively early in his career, entitled Old Man Blue. Old Man Blue, or excuse me, Old Man Blues, anticipates modern jazz performance by virtue of the fact that a considerable portion of this composition is based upon the harmonic foundation, the chord progression of Jerome Kern's 1927 show-stopping number Old Man River from Showa. But something to be show-stopping means that the audience, upon hearing the song, bursts into such loud and sustained applause that it becomes evident that the only way the show can continue is if the song is repeated. The night that Chobo premiered in 1927 in New York, Baritone Jules Bledsoe sang Old Man River. The audience erupted in applause. He sang again. The audience erupted in applause. He sang it a third time. Only then would the musical continue. That is a shortstop. Ellington's use of the chord progressions of Old Man River, or Old Man Blues, is something that, as I said, we will encounter again when we come to modern jazz material. As you can see from this chart, which is taken from the Crawford text, it is a very highly organized arrangement in which the soprano section, the trumpet section, the brass is a section, soloists, trombonists, baritone, saxophonists, and indeed a noodling clarinet part here, all suggest the solo colors against the larger backdrop of the band itself. It's a complicated arrangement. You can see that it begins with an introduction, then most of the harmony of Old Man River. A new section here. The song itself is the foundation for these two and this. And at no time will you hear the melodies of Old Man River. Ellington has replaced the surface of that song with his own melodic invention and with opportunities for his soloists to provide their own melodic invention.
Ruth Crawford would later marry Charlton. Another American whose musical style is best described as minimal.
Regulated in terms of harmony. It was because of the arrangement that was necessitated by needing to coordinate the activities of 12, 13, 14, 15 musicians who themselves were grouped into three broad sections. The reeds, saxophones, doubling on clarinets, the brass, trumpets and trombones, and the rhythm section, piano, bass, drums, and rhythm guitar, characteristic of the rhythm section of the 1930s. Musicians who played in big bands in that period and thereafter, especially those who were interested in the improvisational opportunities that jazz promised, became increasingly bored with the arrangements that they had to play in the dances, especially the sweeter numbers that allowed for virtually no improvisation and almost no swing. What musicians did to compensate for the constraints of their musical day jobs was get together at the end of an evening of performing in a ballroom or some other venue for the public and improvise in jam sessions. These jam sessions served a couple of purposes. The principal one was to determine who's the best on the instrument within the group of musicians. These were highly competitive jam sessions. They were known by some as cutting contests, cutting out those who were not as talented. So highly competitive were some of these jam sessions, these cutting contests, that they could go on for hours. There's a story of the pianist with the Andy Kirk Band, a woman by the name of Mary Lou Williams from Pittsburgh, being rousted out of bed at 6 o'clock in the morning in Kansas City, where the band was based, because two highly competitive tenor saxophonists were in a cutting contest, and all the pianists who were backing them were exhausted. She'd been playing until 2 a.m. And the contest went on at about 8 or 9 in the morning. And it started about 3 in the morning. What happened in the 1940s, because of changes in American culture and society, was that the big band era came to an end. People were no longer interested in going out into public and dining and dancing. Families had to be created. The war was over. People were catching up with the lost years of World War II from 1941 to 1945. American society encouraged people to think in terms of starting families, getting that job, beginning their professional adult lives. And all of that argued against the kind of social life of the 1930s. One of the most important byproducts of that change of social value that led to the formation of families was me. Can you tell a joke twice and come back to the second time? I'll try again.
All right. Wait a second before we get quite a while. Just wait one second.
Okay. One of the most important byproducts of the social change in American culture after World War II and the starting of families was me. Many of these new clubs had a very small dance floor if they had one at all. And it became quite clear the nature of the music that was being played was not music for dancing anyway. This music was modern jazz, or known on the street as bebop. It was music that was driven by improvisation, not by arrangements. It was music in which improvisations could last as long as the individual soloist and the group's leader agreed it could last. It did not depend upon some arrangement or chart that had been drafted well in advance of the occasion of performance and had to be followed so that the whole thing didn't collapse into disorganization. In other words, the cutting contests of the after-hours sessions in the big band era were transformed into the essence of post-World War II jazz. Modern jazz was the jam session sort of regulated and dressed up to be put on stage in a nightclub. How did it have to be regulated and dressed up? Well, one thing, you're not going to go on for 4 hours nonstop. Why? Because a nightclub does not run on the gate, on the door. You know this, I'm sure. That's not where a nightclub makes its money, by charging an admission fee. Where does it make its money? At the bar. Exactly. So you're not going to have 4 hours of continuous music because nobody's going to get up and drink. You figure out a way to have shorter episodes that are improvisationally driven, that allow for breaks, that allow for another round, and so forth. And moreover, modern jazz figured out that it had to conform to the length in recorded music dictated by the 10-inch 78 RPM record. And that, of course, is 3 minutes and 30 seconds. Among the important performers of modern jazz who made this modern music what it is, and what it has largely remained to the present day, is non-functional art music, included a tenor saxophonist from Kansas City, Missouri, named Charlie Parker, a trumpet player from North Carolina named John Gillespie, John Burks Gillespie. I'm sure you'll agree that a name like John Burks Gillespie is the name of a jazz musician, right? Yes. Well, apparently others did because they gave him the nickname Dizzy. Pianist Thelonious Monk and drummer Max Roach, among others. The foundation of modern jazz were these harmonic and melodic inventions. The harmonic invention we've already seen a demonstration of in Duke Ellington's composition from more than a decade earlier. The use of harmonic progressions, chord progressions, changes of pre-composed popular songs. The melodic invention would be entirely new melodies improvised over those harmonies on the spot. That people could do this with such enormous virtuosity was the result of the fact that before they went on stage, they had practice. Practice for the same reason that one practices to master an instrument in the traditional art music. To master the instrument technically, to be able to move about it with great fluency and virtuosity. Parker and Gillespie were fanatic about practicing. The story about them that once they went to a music store and they bought an exercise book. Book of exercises for the trumpet. You know, usual stuff, arpeggiated, scalar, passage work. And they go back to one of their hotel rooms, they put it up on a music stand, and they play it in unison as quickly as they could. One exercise after another, after another, after another, until they got to the book. Then they turned the book upside down and played the exercises from back to front as quickly as they could. Charlie Parker's been recorded, playing a recording of a work with a piano trio, improvising over his own new melodies. on the foundation of a piano trio's rendition of a popular song. It's not only gets you to Carnegie Hall, it gets you to the Village Vanguard practice. This notion of melodic invention can be demonstrated in a composition from November of 1945 that has a title Koko, K-O-K-O, involving both Parker and Gillespie, but Parker most prominent. It's built upon the chords changes, the harmonies, of a composition by a British band leader named Ray Noble. The composition is entitled Cherokee. The original composition that was known to the jazz musicians was a version of Cherokee performed by a band led by a pipe band leader named Charlie Barnett, a tenor saxophone. So just listen to the opening, the 32 bars of Cherokee that, in fact, define this piece.
Thank you.
two ways. It established the agenda for jazz to the present day. People are still working over Parker's material, Gillespie's material. It provides a standard of improvisation for any subsequent jazz musician, much as Armstrong's has always done so as well. It also stripped out a vast majority of big band jazz's audience, black and white. Modern jazz did not meet the purposes of dance music, even though people still wanted to dance. Thus we see, as a consequence of the rise of modern jazz, its audience gradually shrinking to where it is today, about 3% of the audience for music. About the same as Western art music, and being superseded in terms of dance music by the next African American vernacular style, rhythm and blues. Rhythm and blues becomes Black America's dance music in the course of the 1940s and early 50s, and as you know, from rhythm and blues, you get rock and roll, which becomes quite young America's dance music in the 50s and 60s. Now, the notion of improvisation-driven jazz was within the jazz domain extremely powerful, and various subsets of modern jazz style began to appear, particularly after Charlie Parker died in 1955 at the age of 34. He died at an earlier age than did Mozart. We see after his death the fact that many jazz musicians went through a period of reflection. Now that Bird is gone, what can we do with this music? What can we do with what he has established as standards of content and style? And we see in rather short order three different streams of jazz style emerging, running parallel, each with its own audience, several of them engaging musicians back and forth. Hard bop, so called, was a style of music that was, perhaps remains the standard style of modern jazz, mainstream jazz, straight-ahead jazz to this day. Among its most important early practitioners was a disciple of Charlie Parker, the trumpet player from St. Louis, East St. Louis, Illinois, named Miles Davis, who, when Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker broke up their group and each went their separate ways, succeeded Dizzy Gillespie and Parker's band. And John Coltrane, born the same year as Davis, tenor saxophone. Several years after that, we have various musicians flirting with a question that has circled around the history of jazz throughout much of the century, which is, are there elements of jazz style that are compatible with elements of art music? And the two share qualities. And we thus get the notion that there is not only the jazz stream and the art music stream, but in the middle, a third stream of style. And in 1959, we get another example of the shared agenda of art music and jazz in America with the rise of free jazz. Free jazz emerged in 1959. It was led by a saxophonist, alto saxophonist named Ornette Coleman. Ornette Coleman basically declared an end to the pre-existent harmonic foundation of jazz and declared all elements of jazz should be collectively improvised on the spot, spontaneously improvised. You do away with the borrowing of a 32-bar song's harmony, whether it's Cherokee, or I Got Rhythm by George Gershwin, or whatever. such a conversation, there's a striking resemblance to avant-garde art music in America, associated with, among others, John Cage, aleatoric music, or music of chance, when certain ideas are simply presented spontaneously and simultaneously. The term free jazz was taken to describe the style, because it was also the title of an album, a 12-inch LP recording of a 37-minute long performance by 8 musicians that was based upon this collective improvisatory approach. But jazz, even as it innovated, encountered a major challenge in terms of audience, in terms of its position in American dramatic music.
Well, I understand, like, if it's free jazz, it's straight into all of it.
The challenge to jazz by the end of all time.
What instrument did he play? Is he only recording folks in jazz?
Yes, he's an Afro-Saxophone.
You can find more detail on this in the sound.
The challenge the jazz confronted in the course of the 1960s was, of course, the challenge of rock and roll. Particularly as during the course of the early and mid-60s, rock and roll became increasingly sophisticated as a music. This due in large part to the combination of the British invasion, the work of the Beach Boys, and the work of others who were sort of affiliated not only with rock, but also with folk music, such as what's his name? Mr. Zimmerman. Am I talking? Yes. Mr. Zimmerman, the Duluth, Minnesota. Bob Hill was not. Some in the domain of jazz thought to attempt to reach out to that rock-based audience by attempting to marry elements of jazz and elements of rock. They referred to it initially as jazz rock, but again, historically, it has come to be known as fusion. Miles Davis was one of the first to pursue this avenue. And it was a recording, a double album, and again, I keep using the word album to reference the medium of jazz recording in that period, which is long playing 12-inch disc, but it is true that attracted many to this particular subset of jazz style. The elements, as shown in the instrumentation of this album on page 86 of the whole book, reflects the rock influence as well as the jazz influence. We now have, where we did not before, the use of electronic keyboards, amplified guitars, amplified bass guitars under bass guitar. Yes, we had had solo guitars in jazz before that, that's not a question. But we did not have the approach to the performance on the instrument or its timbres that are characteristic of rock until this particular composition. Not only that, but the drumming is that as well, with a steady, unrelenting beat, as opposed to the more spontaneous kind of drumming associated with modern jazz, where the drummer may keep time on the cymbal and use the snare not to establish and maintain a regular pattern, but to comment, to sort of punctuate phrases of the soloing musicians with a series of short, quick, irregular drum solos. This particular composition, Spanish Key, does give us one example of this new fusion style. Thank you. Harmony was subordinated in terms of the foundation of this music to the beat as well as to the collective solo that was going on. Put another way, free jazz and Spanish key in this case. There are many elements in common, even though obviously Spanish key is harmonically grounded in a way that free jazz is not. Jazz since the 1970s has not really developed significant new styles. Some have been predicting jazz's demise for years, but indeed, other scholars take the position that, in a sense, all of those changes of style I have noted here since World War II are changes of motivated as much by the music industry seeking the newest, the latest, the hippest in musical style, ready to label anything as new, when quite clearly it is simply the elaboration of a previously established practice. Jazz has moved into the academy, as you know. We have courses in jazz, a major in jazz. The focus of our study tends to be the jazz of the period of the 50s and 60s in terms of quest for style, personal style. That's what the young man master. And of course, by the end of the 70s, yet another new African-American style bursts on the scene, or the burst or emerges on the scene. Another alternative expression, of course, as I mentioned before, and that is rap, later to be called hip-hop. Okay, are there any questions? All right, your turn. I'm getting out of here. Stand.